Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Lisa Alcoholic. And I just want to thank you so much for having me here tonight. I'm so excited to be here, and I want to thank Mark for inviting me. We've been doing some phone tag, and we got up here, and I'm so excited to be here. And I brought my friend Lori, and we've been having a girls' trip. Woo! And we've been touristy. We did all the touristy things in Seattle. We were the couple of girls that were standing on the corner with a map. And we're like, if you turn the map this way and the hotel's behind you and you go this, and we had no idea. So we did a lot of backtracking and we've just had a great time. So I just want to thank you guys. I want to thank all the committee here that sets up. You know, I know it's a lot of work to do that, and I'm just so grateful. And I'm pretty sure tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up and not come to. And I will not have to go on the search of the clothes and the car and the keys and the debit card and the pool stick. Because usually one, if not all of those, were missing. And I just love it. You know, I just look out there and I think, you know, normally we are a group that would not mix. But here there exists a fellowship and a friendliness and an understanding that is indescribably wonderful. And that's how I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot put into words what this program means to me, except I bet there's some of you that feel the same way I do, right? That feel the same way I do. And I always get a little nervous up here because I always think that my story is not that exciting. When I got here, I heard all the differences and none of the similarities. And you guys had some good stories, man. You had some cop chases and car crashes and bar fights, right? And handcuffs, and you were sleeping under bridges and peeing in your pants and dumpster diving. And I was like, none of that happened to me, except for the handcuffs. I always like to forget that part. But, you know, I always felt like my story was like, ho-hum. And thank God I had a sponsor, and she would say to me, Lisa, you can put down the shovel anytime. Your story only has to impress you. And I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful that my story impressed me enough to do just that. I'm so thankful. And after working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned that there were some things in my life that created the alcoholic that I became. One of them was when I was 4 years old, very young, my mom passed away very suddenly. She died of lupus, which today is a manageable, if not curable, disease. But back in 72, they just didn't know a lot about it. My mom literally went off for a Sunday drive and never came home. And the story goes, she went off with my dad for this drive, and she turned to him and said, I think you better take me to the hospital. And he did. And she died 3 days later. And right or wrong, my dad didn't take me to the hospital. I really don't think he thought she was going to die. So I was with a babysitter. And then 3 days after that, while they planned the funeral, and right or wrong, I didn't go to the funeral. And I don't have a memory of that time, but I can only imagine what a four-year-old brain thinks, right? When your mom just disappears one day and she's just gone, and you have no concept of why or what happened, no closure. And so it just kind of grew that alcoholic feeling, you know, that I wasn't loved enough to have a mom. And I just remember the feeling of always wanting a mom to love and always wanting a mom to love me. So my mom died in February. By Mother's Day, I was ready to do some mom shopping. And by October that very same year, my dad remarried to my mom, to my mom I have today. And I call her mom because she's the only mom I know. I love my mom. We have a good relationship, but my mom and I are vastly different. I'm the kind of person where I just want to hug you and kiss you and pet you and love you. And my mother does not. And so I don't remember a time of her really holding me or kissing me or rocking me or any of those things. I'm not saying it didn't happen. This is just my perception. And so I kind of grew up just never feeling quite like I was enough to be loved. And I never quite felt like I measured up. My mom always had a to-do list for me. You know, you need to do, you didn't do, why didn't you do, you knew to do. And I just felt like she set a bar. I never quite could reach it, or it moved, or it changed. And I never felt like I was there. And I don't say this to be disparaging about my mom. I love my mom. I just tell you this because, again, it just created that alcoholic feeling, right? That feeling of first feeling unloved, not worthy enough, and now I feel like I don't quite measure up, and it's just growing in me. It's just growing. But, you know, I had a good childhood. I had great parents. They were non-alcoholic. And I went to middle school, and what can you say about middle school? And you guys, you just have to picture me at middle school, okay? By eighth grade, I'm the height I am today, 6'3", super fun. And and I was just skinny and gangly, and I had a mouth full of braces and a cap full of curls from a perm gone bad. And I was just awkward and gangly, and oh, and I just stood out. And people were noticing my height, you know, and I just love, even today, people love to come up to me, and they love to say, "Hey, you're really tall," right? And I just love it because they're so cute. It's like they're imparting this thing to me like, "Oh, you didn't know you're really, really tall," right? And usually I get one or two questions afterwards. So I usually get, "Hey, you're really tall. Did you play basketball?" And sometimes when I'm a little snarky, I'm like, "No, nope. I was a gymnast. Yeah, I was really good, really good. I almost made it to the Junior Olympics, but I did the uneven bars and I kept hitting my head." So I just, they look at me, "Really? Gymnast, huh?" And the other question I always get is, "Hey, you're really tall. How tall are you?" And so one summer I decided that I would charge $1 if you wanted to know my height. So you had to pay me $1. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to charge the men because I love me my girls. So I'm just going to charge the men $1. So if you wanted to know my height, you had to pay me $1. And that summer I made $72. I kid you not. Now, I do have to tell you the results might be a little skewed because I was living in the bar. So just keep that in mind. But $72, and I was so proud of it. I'm like, I'm going to go to Vegas. It's going to be my spending money. I'm so great. And, of course, I never got off the bar stool. But in eighth grade, man, I was so embarrassed that people were noticing my height and I was standing out and people were coming up to me. And I just, again, it just created that feeling, right? Now I don't feel one of. I feel different than, apart from. And all I wanted to do was fit in. All I wanted was for you to like me as much as I loved you. And it didn't feel that way in my skin. So I went off to high school, and whatever was in the water that year, there was a lot of tall girls. It was led by Tracy Mulder. She was 6'3" also, but she was like the Marilyn Monroe of tall girls. She had big boobs and blonde hair and dated all the seniors her freshman year, and she was super cool. And then there was my friend Sandy. She was 6'1". There was another girl, Lisa, 6'. There was 5'10", 5'11" girls, just a whole gaggle of us, and we all played sports, and I got to be a little bit on the outskirt of popular just because they all were, so I was kind of the hanger on. And, you know, I hadn't drank yet, and I was a good kid, and I got good grades, you know, but it was just waiting in there. It was just churning in me that I just didn't feel quite there. And my first drink was actually a magical, magical event. And what happened was my basketball team, in case you missed it, I did play basketball. In case you're like, "What? I thought she was a gymnast." No. I did play basketball, and we lost the state championship to St. Mary's Academy in Portland. And we had lost to them the state championship in volleyball, so lost in volleyball and then basketball. We were sad little puppies. And we were out commiserating with our parents at dinner, and there was talk of a party, and my mom immediately said, "Absolutely not." And my dear, sweet, innocent daddy was like, "Well, Jan, she's very sad. She should go to the party. She'll have fun. Cheer up." So it was decided I could go, and I went to the party. And when I got there, I immediately knew I had made a tactical error because I looked inside, and there was packed, and there was boys talking to girls, and everybody was dancing and having a good time. And I'm like, I'm going to walk in like the Jolly Green Giant. This is not for me. But somebody handed me a red plastic cup, and I took a sip of warm beer. A lot of fuzz on the top, and wasn't good. But I looked around, and you guys were all drinking out of a red plastic cup too, and I just wanted to be like you. So I took another sip, and I took another sip, and I took another sip, and something magical started to happen. I kid you not. I started shrinking. I'm serious. I totally started shrinking. And by like the third cup, I was like 5'3" and a supermodel. And I could talk to the boys, and they were talking to me, and I was dancing, and I was funny. And for the first time, I fit in. For the first time, I felt part of. For the first time, I felt like you liked me as much as I loved you. And that feeling of the shoulders down and the breath in. And oh, I love that feeling. I love that feeling of finally feeling right-sized and right skin. And I chased that the rest of my drinking career. But You know, I didn't become alcoholic overnight. I graduated. There were some drinking parties here and there and, you know, some stolen liquor from the parents' liquor cabinet. There was one night we all went skinny dipping, a bunch of us, and the cops came and they recognized us from the basketball team because I guess when a bunch of 6-foot girls come out of the water in their birthday suits, they're like, yeah, we know who they are. And it was a small town, so they just took us home, you know. But then I went off to college and I had a full ride at Boise State University and went up there, and my parents drove me 437 miles away for the first time in my life. I am all alone, right? And I remember standing in the parking lot, and my parents are driving off, and I know not a soul. And once again, I know I've made a technical error, you know, because I just don't know anyone, and I'm scared to death. I'm scared to death. And all of those feelings come back, all of those feelings. And I met the team the first week of school. And unbeknownst to me, they had put all the athletes into one dorm, Chapin Hall. They had the girls on one side and the boys on the other, but all the football players, basketball, track, soccer, volleyball, all of us. And it was a little hallway in between. It was patrolled by a little man named Elliot. He had very jingly keys. So you always knew when he was coming. It's always a good sign. And I guess they thought if they put all the athletes in one dorm, we wouldn't drink. We're athletes, right? No. How many of you know? Some of you out there are laughing. Yeah, it was a crazy dorm. There was drinking 24/7, partying, I mean, pranks, all kinds of stuff happening. But none of this was known to me that first week of school. And so I remember I was walking down the hallway with the other center named Jan. She was super shy, super sweet girl. And we go past this dorm room, and I look in, and there's this girl sitting on the dorm bed. And she said, "Let's party!" And I looked Jan at, she looked at me, and Jan said, "I don't think so." And I said, "Hell yeah, this is where I'm getting off, right?" And I walked into that dorm room, and I swear for 3 years I didn't come out. And you guys, my drinking took me down hard and fast. Let me tell you, my freshman year, I started on that basketball team. I was a good kid, and I got good grades. And by my junior year, I had been kicked off the team for drinking. I had been caught on the drug test for smoking marijuana, and I was pregnant. And that's where my drinking took me. You know, my drinking had me doing demoralizing, humiliating, horrible things. My drinking had me doing things that I would never do sober. And it was awful. And my drinking put me into dangerous situations, and in one case, I didn't get out of it. And it changed me as a woman forever. And I wish I could impart to young women, you know, the dangers of drinking and decision making. So I came home with my tail between my legs, and I had my daughter Kylie, and I married her father, and I'm proud to say that we both graduated from college, and we got jobs, and we settled into married life, and we bought a little house, and 2 years later we had my son David, and I married a very controlling man. He controlled what we did, where we went, how we spent our money. So I really didn't drink a lot during that time. I didn't have the opportunity. I didn't have a lot of friends. He was off doing his thing, and I was just home being a good mom. And I'm very thankful for that. I'm very thankful for that. But after 11 years, I got a little tired of that, so I divorced him and got off on my own, and I had a couple years of good sobriety. But then I met a little teacher, and she was 29, and I was 39, and she liked to party, and I decided I did too. And a couple things happened, right? A couple things happened when I got divorced. One is, I got girlfriends again. I hadn't had girlfriends in like 11 years. And you don't know this about me, but I love me some girlfriends. I love girl trips, right, Lori? Woo! We had a good time. And I remember the very first trip we took, we were going to Long Beach, Washington. My grandma had a little cabin up there, a little yellow shack there, and we called it the Doll's Clam Shack. And we went up there, and I remember we were in the car heading, and I was like, oh, I'm so excited! We're going on a girls trip! So excited! We're in there! We're girls! We're going to be girls! We're going on the girls trip! We're going to have so much fun! They're like, Lisa, you are going to have to calm down. We are not even out of the driveway yet. Bring it down. Bring it down. But I just loved it, you guys. We went on these trips, and we would come back, and we would have secret handshakes and secret language, and we had people that wanted to be like us. And, you know, I just, once again, it was that feeling of belonging, right? That feeling of being a part of. And another thing that happened is my alcoholic brain was just waiting for this moment. It had been waiting. It had been back there doing push-ups. And it was ready to rationalize and justify. And here's what it said to me. It said, Lisa,
You raised those kids single-handedly. You did everything. You were out there coaching soccer and going to their open houses and their conferences. You were at all their dance meets. You were doing all of that all by yourself. You deserve this. It's your time now. You worked hard. They're in high school. They can handle it themselves. You just go off and have a good time. And that's what my brain was saying to me. And of course, none of that was true. I hadn't done anything else that a typical mom doesn't do on a typical day, right? And actually in high school, it's kind of the worst time to leave your kids alone. You know, but that's what my brain told me, and I believed it. You know, I believed it. And once again, I started drinking, and the consequences started happening. And one of the first consequences, it was my friends got sick and tired of my drinking. They got sick and tired of babysitting me, making sure I got home safe. One of my friends stopped talking to me. I had no idea why. When I pulled it out of her finally, you know, and it was because of my drinking, I just couldn't believe it. My drinking, it's a problem. So I went home that night and I devised the drunk plan. Very proud of this plan. The drunk plan is an acronym. Each letter stands for a part of my plan. So the D in drunk is don't drink and drive. No longer could I drive home drunk. I needed to find a way home. I needed to figure it out beforehand. No longer were they going to try to wrestle the keys from me. The R in drunk stood for respectable volume. So I needed to bring it down. I know, I was so proud of that one. That was the longest one. It took me that one, the longest one to get the R. The U in drunk stood for use a condom, safe sex. The N was no uglies. So my friends could vote whether or not I could leave with the guy. Because my requirement in the past had been, hey, are you breathing? Oh, okay. Can you walk to my car? All right, it's good. Two requirements, that's it. So they could vote whether or not I could leave with the guy. And the K was know your limits. So I needed to do things like put a food layer in. Never a good idea. Put a food layer in. Put some water in between your drinks. You know, only drink straight shots. Only drink rum and diet. I don't know. But they seemed to think that I should have a limit to my drinking. And you know, the drunk plan worked. For a while it worked. You know, things got a little bit better. And I learned a couple things from my drunk plan. The first thing I learned was I just needed to quiet down. If I just quieted down a little bit, my friends didn't quite know how drunk I was. Just quiet down. And the other thing I learned was these were not my drinking peeps. I needed to go find some people that drank like I did, right? So that was my warm-up crew. I would warm up with them. And then when everybody else was like, we're going home, I'm like, me too. And I went up and I found a bar named Rotters. It was kind of bar where everybody knows your name, and I loved it. And when I went in there, man, everybody knew my name. Probably helped that I bought everybody a straight shot every time I was there, but, you know, everybody knew my name. And you guys, they didn't care how much I drank. They didn't care if I was loud and obnoxious. They didn't care who I left with. They didn't care if I was embarrassing. In fact, they kind of encouraged it. They thought it was great. And, you know, I finally felt again that these were my peeps. This is where I needed to be drinking, because these were the people that drank like I did. And once again, I felt a part of, and it felt like home. You know, and I loved it. And the other consequences, you know, my kids would call me in the evenings, because by that time I had met a guy and he was on a pool team, and he convinced me to start playing pool, and I fell in love with it. And so being the good alcoholic, one team didn't seem like enough. So I went on another team, and being the good participant that I am, the good teammate, I wanted to practice. So I practiced a lot. So pretty soon I was living at the bar, and my kids would be calling me at night, and they would say, Mom, are you going to come home? Are you coming home to cook dinner? I'd be like, of course I am, kids. I'm just going to play this one quick game of pool, and then I'll be right there. And an hour later, they'd call, and they'd say, Mom, are you still coming home to cook dinner? I'd say, of course I am, kids. This game just took me a little longer than I thought. You know, and pretty soon they stopped calling, because pretty soon I stopped answering the phone. And my kids were left home alone, and my kids took very different paths during this time. My daughter, she put her nose in a book, and she did amazing and incredible things. And she, by her senior year, was captain of the dance team and valedictorian, and I missed it all. I missed all of it. You know, and here's just one story that was kind of the epitome of what it was like. So her senior year, her dance team put on this big production with the middle school, and at the end of it, they had this big dance, and at the end of the dance, all the captains called down their parents, and they told them mushy-gushy stuff and gave them flowers, and she invited me, her mom, and of course I was going to be there. But I just needed a little liquid courage, you know, because it's hard to get up in front of a lot of people. I just needed a little liquid courage. And of course, I was going to be there. So I was going to go play one game of pool and have a little liquid courage.
And we all know where that went, right? So I remember I was running down the hallway towards the gym, and I get to the gym, and the doors are closed, and there's that little rectangular window, and I look inside, and the stands are packed. And there's my daughter, and she's standing in the middle of the gym floor all by herself. She's got a microphone in one hand and flowers in her arm, and there is nobody standing with her. You know, and to this day, I don't know what she told that crowd about where her mom is. All I know is that is one of many things that I missed her senior year. Many things. And my son took a very opposite path. My son was like, let's see. Mom's gone, and we have a house that's empty. I wonder what I could do with that. So, of course, the parties began, and my son threw a party all the time. He ended up getting pretty heavily into drugs. He started selling, got pretty high up on the food chain. Some dangerous things were happening to my house with my daughter in it by herself. And we had our house got egged. We had rocks thrown. We got broken into, stolen. A lot of things went on. And, you know, my alcoholic brain by this time had to really stretch itself to rationalize and justify. And it would say things like, it's just the neighborhood you live in. You know, if you lived in a different neighborhood, things would be different. And so, you know, at that point, I was willing to listen to everything to keep doing what I was doing. And I ignored all the signs. And, you know, in the end, you guys, it wasn't about what I had lost. It was about me. I had lost my soul. You know, I had lost my soul. I could not believe the woman and the mother that I had become. I was so embarrassed. And those handcuffs I always like to forget, you know, I did. I got a Dewey finally, one of many I should have gotten. And I went to court for the Dewey, and I recognized some of the women that had been in the drunk tank with me. And the judge called a whole gaggle of them up there, and he talked to them about this diversion plan for first-time offenders. And I thought, well, that's weird. I'm a first-time offender. But I had never been to court before, so I wasn't sure what to do. And I waited until they called my name, and I went up there, and the judge said, what are we here for? And the prosecutor stood up, and he said, this is Lisa Kostelic, and we're here because she has been arrested for cocaine possession, her third-time offense. And I'm like, oh. That's not me. That's not me. I've never done cocaine in my life. That's not me. And the prosecutor said, what else are we here for? And he said, well, also she's been arrested for prostitution, her third time offense. And I'm like, oh, that's not me. I gave it away for free. Like, that's not me. That's not me. And I'm just flapping like this because I don't know what to do. And I just keep repeating, that's not me. And the judge kind of looks at me, but he turns back to the prosecutor and he's like, well, what are you recommending? And at this point, I have no idea what the prosecutor said. What I heard is we recommend $100 million fine and 100 million years in jail. And I'm just picturing myself off in handcuffs and dragged off to jail. And I don't know what to do. And so I'm just flapping and I'm like, that's not me. That's really not me. And the judge finally kind of says, takes pity on me and pulls up the file and says, let me see the file. And they bring it up to him, and he's looking through it as slow as molasses, just looking through it. Looks up at me, laying at the paper, and he says, ma'am, how tall are you? Like, really? I kind of straighten up, and I say, well, sir, I'm 6'3". And he said, well, I think this is not you, Lisa Kostelic, because it says right here she's 5'3". And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Thank God finally being tall worked out. Thank you, God. I mean, oh, my gosh. So, yes, I did get diversion. I'm very happy to say. It did slow me down. Do you know, though, when you ever go to meetings and you hear about people that go out and then they come back in and they talk about their drinking and how it started right where it left off, if not even worse? And that was my experience. You know, when diversion was over, it was on. You know, and I started drinking just as much as I was, if not even worse. And in the end, I was just miserable and I didn't know what to do about it. And I remember I would come to in the morning, and I could not face the day. I didn't want to open my eyes to face the kids or what I had done, and I didn't want to keep them closed because I would replay the things I did remember from the night before. And those four hideous horsemen were standing right at the end of my bed. And I was so sick to my stomach, and I had that awful pit in me. And I didn't know what to do, and I would pray to a God in those mornings because I've always had a God in my life. I've always believed in God. And I would say, God, tonight I'm not going to drink, I promise. Tonight I'm going to come home, and I'm going to be a good mom, and I'm going to make dinner, and I'm going to help them with their homework, and I'm going to be a good mom. And you guys, I meant it. I meant it with all my heart. And that night I would look around, and I'd be sitting on a bar stool, and I had no idea how I got there, and I'd pound on the bar, say, for God's sake, how did I ever get here? Only to have that thought supplanted by, well, I'll stop on the 6, or what's the use anyhow?
You know, and the big book talks about that, that insidious insanity of the first drink. And it's strange to say, but sometimes a man has no more idea of why he took that first drink than you do. And that was me. I could not understand how I could love my children with all my heart and all my soul, and I would pick the drink every single time over them. How could I do that? You know, and I was just miserable. And you guys, getting into AA is a total God shot. It has nothing to do with me and everything to do with my God. And what happened was I went to Rotter's one morning to go pick up my debit card, $350 tab, not unusual. And there was a friend of mine, and she was sitting there having some lunch, and I said, "Little pumpkin pie, where you been? I haven't seen you for so long." And she said, "Oh, I got a Dewey. So I'm going to those AA meetings." And she looked me right in the eye, and she said, "You should come." And I looked at her and said, "Okay." And the next night we went to an AA meeting. We went to Altered Attitudes at the Pink Church in Oregon City, 5:30. It is a daily meeting. And you never know when you're going to get there, right, Lori? It is crazy, good fun, man. It is wonderful, wonderful meeting. We love it. And I went in there, and you guys were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and you were talking and laughing and talking, and I was so excited, and I instantly fell in love with you guys. And I don't know what you said at that meeting, but after the meeting, there was a meeting underneath a tree, right? All the smokers were out there smoking, and I was a smoker, so I was out there smoking, and I was looking around, and again, you guys were just, you were laughing and clapping and hugging and kissing. And I was like, this is like the bar without drinking. I loved it. I loved it. I fell in love with you instantly. And that night we had to go back to the bar because I was on a pool team. Had to go play some pool. And my friend came with me and she started drinking. And I'm like, wait a minute. I thought that if you were going to those meetings, you weren't drinking. But I didn't drink that night. It's not my sobriety date, but for whatever reason, I just got to see a little glimpse of myself. Because my friend got really drunk, and she got a little bit embarrassing, and a little bit loud, and a little bit obnoxious. She did things like drunk dial her boyfriend in the program. Don't recommend that. Not a good idea. But you know, I just got a little glimpse of myself. But like I said, it's not my sobriety date. I actually didn't think I was an alcoholic. Like I said, I heard all the differences, and you guys had lost so much, and you had done so much, and I was like, that's not me. I still looked good from the outside. So I didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I loved you guys. So I went to meetings, and I drank in between. And I did that for 2 months. And if you're new here with that little new girl there, I don't recommend it. Please hear me say that. But you guys, it was the best I could do because I just loved you. And you know what I love about you guys? You never kicked me out. You never once told me to leave. You never once told me to get out. In fact, you told me to keep coming back. You told me that in your third tradition, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I had that desire. I just didn't know what to do with it. So you guys allowed me to stay there, and I will be forever grateful for that. I will be forever grateful that you allowed me to concede to my innermost spot that I was an alcoholic, and you allowed me to stay. And so I stayed for 2 months, and sometimes I even spoke because I thought I had something to say. And after 2 months, this old-timer Big John, he got tired of listening to me, and he was like, "Lisa, you need to go home and read out of the big book. You go home." And I had a big book, and I had read Bill's story about some guy named Bill and World War whatever. I don't know. It didn't apply to me. He said, "You go home. You read out of the big book. You read The River of Denial. It's in the back. You go home and read that." And he's a little scary. So, and I was a little willing. So I went home and read it. And it's a story about a woman, and when she controls her drinking, she doesn't enjoy it. And when she enjoys her drinking, she can't control it. And for the first time, I heard myself in the pages of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the big book talks about that too, right? That somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking as the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And the persistence of this illusion is astonishing, right? Many pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. And that was me. And the part that really got me was the part that she said that got her, that made her want to try this sober thing. And that was the laughter, the pure joy in the laughter that she heard only in a sober alcoholic. And you guys laugh like that. And I hadn't laughed like that for so long. So that Monday, I dragged my butt back into that pink church, and I said, I'm Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm here to get sober. And that was August 11th in 2008, and thank God to this program, and my God, I haven't had to take a drink since. And I'm so grateful for that, you guys. I'm so grateful. And you know, I started just doing the things that you suggested. And you said go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did more than that. And you said that I better get a home group so I'm not homeless, and I made that pink church my home group, Altered Attitudes. And somebody said, you better get a service position so you get out of yourself. So I started making coffee every Friday night. And somebody else said, you better read the big book, and you'll be happy to know I got past Bill's story. You know, and I just did the things that you guys suggested. And my life didn't suddenly become butterflies and buttercups. Right? Life on life's terms. In fact, my very first month of sobriety, my son, who was a senior at that point, he beat up a kid pretty badly and sent him to the hospital. And that school was sick and tired of him and his antics, and they were ready to expel him. And my son and I talked, and we decided that we would go in and tell the truth. We would tell what was going on in our life. And unbeknownst to me, he was trying to clean up his act too. And you know what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is you guys taught me that. You guys did. Because you allowed me to stay there for those 2 months, I heard things like suit up and show up, tell the truth, do the next right thing, let go and let God, keep it simple, stupid. And all of those sayings. And that's what we did. You know, his dad wanted to hire a lawyer and fight. And we said, no, we're going to go in and tell the truth. And that's what we did. And we walked into this big important meeting, and there was a whole panel of important looking people. You know, the lady had pencil skirts and buns in their hair, and the men had suits and ties. And there was a doctor or director or some kind of acronym in front of every name. And they looked big and scary. And we just sat down and told the truth. And I just said, I'm Lisa, alcoholic. I have just gotten sober. I've just come up from air to survey the damage. And my son and I are extremely sorry. We're willing to do whatever it takes to make this right, but we're also willing to live with whatever consequence you have. And my son did the same thing. You know, and thanks to that, what we did, they didn't kick my son out. They sent him to an alternative school called Eastham. And here's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous and my God. My God works through you guys. My son, if he had stayed in high school, he could have never graduated. There just wasn't enough hours in the day in a classroom for him to get enough credits to graduate. But because they sent him to this alternative school, he sat in front of a computer and did one assignment after another until he passed one class after another and got one credit after another. And that June, I stand before you to tell you that I watched my son graduate with his graduating class and walk across that stage and get his diploma. And that is all because of you guys. I can never thank you enough for that. Because you allowed me to stay there and because I heard all of your saying, I did the next right thing and God did the rest. And my son got to graduate. And I will be forever thankful to you guys for that. I can never give back enough for that. You know, and so my son got to graduate, and I'm so thankful. And there was a guy in my home group named Mark, and he would say all the time to me, hey, you got a sponsor? 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 Every day. Every day. It was so annoying. And I'm like, I don't know. What is a sponsor? You dial 1-800, I get a sponsor. You do a secret handshake. You fill out a resume. What do? Where do you go? What happens? And so I realized that I just needed to listen until I heard a woman that had what I wanted. And I just needed to ask her to be my sponsor. And that's what I did. And Jeannie Beanie became my sponsor. And we started to work the steps. And I'm so grateful whenever I think about Bill and Bob, and they wrote these steps and they put them in the order that they did. Because when we first started working, I was like, I'm ready. Step 9. Let's go. I need to make me some amends. Let's go. I'm ready for step 9. I did some damage with my kids. Let's go. And my sponsor was like, no, Lisa, I'm so sorry. We're going to start on step 1. See, 9 comes after 8, which comes after 7. See a pattern here? Yeah. Okay. We're going to start with step 1, and we'll get to 9 when we get to it. And I'm so thankful, you guys. Thank goodness. You know, thank goodness that I didn't start where I wanted to start with step 9. Because if I had made my amends at that point, it would have been all about me and relieving my mom guilt and nothing about my kids. You know, I needed to do the work that it took to get to that step 9. And I'm so grateful. And I just love the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm here to tell you that I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love service work in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I believe to my core that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the 12 steps
of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought when I got here, I could get it by osmosis. If I sat in those blue plastic chairs in Altered Attitudes long enough, you know, it would come through the floor and into me and I'd be saved. And that is not the case that I've found. You know, I'm so grateful that I had a sponsor and I had a group that really talked about the 12 steps. Because I believe if you are here sitting in meetings and doing the fellowship, you are selling yourself short and you are selling the program short. You know, the 12 steps are where it's at. And so we began working the steps. And I'm so grateful, you know, because I needed to concede in my innermost self in step one, you know, that I was an alcoholic, no doubt about it. And I needed to find my God and make him even bigger and even better. And what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, I love so many things about Alcoholics Anonymous, but one of the things I love is that my God doesn't have to look like your God, right? You can borrow my God, use my God, but your God can be your God. You know, my God is all about Jesus Christ. Man, I am a JC girl all the way, but your God can be different. My good friend Shauna, she is all about her creator and nature, and she loves that about her creator and her higher power. And she married a Native American, and they've got a sweat lodge in their backyard, and they are saving alcoholics one sweat at a time, you know, and they're doing vision quests, and her God is beautiful and big and gorgeous, and it doesn't have to look like my God. And if you're sitting there and you're worried about this God concept, don't worry. Don't worry. You get to come up with your own concept. You don't have to have my God. You can form your own. And I love that. I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I needed my God to be big to get through that fourth and fifth step where I really took a look at myself and looked at my character defects and looked at where my side of the street was. And I needed to do all of that work in six and seven before I got to step nine. And that's what I did, and I'm so grateful. Because when I finally went to go make those amends to my children, I was ready. You know, I was ready, and I made my amends to my daughter first, and I told her all the things I needed to say, and she was in college by this time, and she accepted my amends. I don't really think she thought I was done drinking, but she accepted it. And then I went and made my amends to my son, and I said, you know, went through my whole thing, and I said at the end, you know, I am so sorry, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make this right. And I'm willing to listen to whatever you have to say. And my son looked at me right in the eye and he said, Mom, how could you? How could you? How could you leave me there by myself? You knew what was going on. You knew what was happening. You knew I needed help. How could you do that to me? How could you leave me alone? How could you not step in? How could you not help me? How could you not stop me? And you know, he was right. He was right. I didn't want to see any of that. And you know, the beautiful thing about waiting till step nine at step nine is I got to say that. And I knew to say that. I knew to say, you're right. And how sorry I was. You know, but that big bat of mom guilt, anybody else have that big bat? Oh man, I picked that up and went to town and I just didn't see it coming. I was just shocked and mortified and I didn't know what to do. And thank God I had been in the program because I knew enough to get my butt to a meeting and share with my sponsor. And I knew to share in a general way in a meeting and share with my sponsor specifics. And my sponsor said, Lisa, you cannot take this on and shoulder this. You need to lift your son up to God. You just lift him up to God and you just do the next right thing and be a living amends. And that's what I did. And I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful for that. And in case you're sitting out there and you're like, wow, this sobriety thing sounds really fun. I really think it's for me. You guys, I'm so serious. I'm here to tell you that I have had more fun in Alcoholics Anonymous than you can shake a stick at. You know, it is so much fun. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. There is more things to do in the summer. You can go on campouts and picnics and barbecues and rafting. And I just love it. The fellowship is alive and well. And I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know how sometimes you hear about sponsors and they have their sponsee write down, what do you hope and wish for in year five, right? In year five, write it down and we're going to seal it up. And they seal it up, and then in year five, they open it up, and usually you hear more oftentimes than not that they've sold themselves short, right? And that's the case for me. Like, I cannot believe the life that I lead today is the life I have. You know, I got to get married in Alcoholics Anonymous. I married the man of my dreams, and there was a little 13-stepping going on, I'm not going to lie. If you're new here, I don't recommend it.
But you know what? It works because we work it. You know, we both work a program and we don't work each other's. We both have a sponsor and we work the steps. We're both currently in the steps right now. We both work with men and women through the steps. We both have service positions, home groups, and we're just visible in the program because we love the program. You know, and we got to build 2 years ago our dream home. I mean, my gosh, I come from a low-income housing. You know, I lived in low-income housing for many years with cement floors and mold on the walls. And now I live in my dream house and I just have to pinch myself. You know, I just have to pinch myself. And while we were building it, we lived with my mother-in-law for 8 months. Super fun. We lived in my husband's, actually his old room that he grew up in a little tiny bed, a full bed, 2 6-foot-3 people. Super fun. And he always used to kid that if you put a Kiss poster on a wall and a bong in a corner, it would be 1978 all over again for him. But it was great, you guys. I'm so glad that we did that. I'm so glad we had that opportunity. And when we were cleaning out our house, my house, to get it to sell, I ran across a letter that my daughter had written. And she wrote a letter, I think, on the behest of a counselor, and I wanted to read it for you now. I have to put on my little glasses, too, because I'm a little old lady now. There you go. Woo! Good to see you. Good to see you. Here's the letter my daughter Kylie wrote. I'm mad at you because I feel that one day you just decided to give up on raising us. I felt like it was just easy for you to give more importance to alcohol than to your own children. It was especially hard for me my senior year when I was captain of the dance team and you only saw one performance. I worked hard to become valedictorian, but throughout senior year, I don't think any of this mattered to you. It made me angry waiting up for you until the early hours of the morning on a school night because I was scared of where you were and what happened to you. I'm mad that David and I had to call and yell at you for driving drunk, even though you'd hang up on us and eventually stopped answering the phone. I feel like at the time you wouldn't do these same things for us. I'm mostly angry about what happened to David. With Dad gone, he needed a parent, and without one, he has become a drug addict and a juvenile delinquent who deals. Most of the time when I'm angry, it's from looking at David and seeing what your neglect has done. I think it's too late now. But I wish that during those years, you would have just opened up your eyes once. I'm angry that now you have no guidance in his life. He does what he wants, when he wants, as always. Despite everything, I want you to know that I'm okay, I'm happy, and I know that you love me as much as I love you. Right? Right in the gut. Right in the gut. And once again, I didn't see it coming. I didn't expect it. And once again, I knew where to go. I knew to come to you guys. I knew to go to a meeting and share in a general way and get a hold of my sponsor and share specifics. And that's what I did. And I'm so grateful once again. I'm so grateful that I was in the middle of this program, because if that had happened when I wasn't in the middle of this, you can be assured that that was a good reason to go get a drink for me. And I need to stay in the middle of this thing. If I'm not in the middle of this program, man, I'm going to get picked off like a zebra by a lion. And I have a lady in my home group named Vivian, and she always says, I have a disease that tells me I don't have it. And that is so true for me today. I'm the kind of an alcoholic that I still drive by Rotters and I try to look inside. And I can't see inside because it's at an angle and the windows are blacked out, but I'm still looking. And my brain starts going and it's like, hey, I heard they had a remodel. You probably could go check that out. That seems really good. You know, and pretty soon I'm starting to think about that. I need to be in the center of this program, you know, and I'm so thankful for that. And just a little bit ago, man, I was feeling like I was skating on my laurels, right? Resting on my laurels. And the big book talks about that too, that we are headed for trouble if we do, because alcohol is a subtle foe, right? We are never cured of alcoholism. All we have is a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual maintenance. And that's what I needed to do. I needed to shake things up. So I went and found me another home group. I love Altered Attitudes. They will always be the one that got me sober, but I needed to find the solution again. And so I found a home group called Jam, Just a Meeting. It's in West Lynn, Friday night, 7 o'clock. I used to be able to say that Lori and I would make your coffee if you came, but we just gave up that position and the attitude of
rotation. But we love it there. And I also needed to find a new sponsor. I love Jeannie Beanie. She was always the sponsor that got me sober, but I needed a new sponsor that I was seeing more. And so I made Bonnie my sponsor, and we were working on the steps, and I'm so glad I just got through step 5. Woo! Took a while. And I'm so grateful, you guys, that I'm in the middle of this thing. And I get to be a GSR again. I don't know if you're a GSR, if you've ever been, but I love being a GSR, and I love going to area. I don't know what Washington area is like, but Oregon area is on fire, man. We are on fire. We have people fighting over the roles, and we have to go to the hat because so many people want to be of service. And I just love it. If you've never been to the Oregon area or Washington area, you know, try it out. It is super fun, super alive. AA is well and breathing and good, and it can light your fire too. And I just love that. I love being a service also. And I just need all of that. I need all of that because, again, it's life on life's terms, right? AA doesn't ever promise you that your life is going to be perfect, that you'll never have a stumble again. It promises that you're going to change, right? That's what AA promised me. And so last year when I turned 50, we went to Vegas, and oh, it was the trip of a lifetime. All our friends came, my family came, my kids came, my parents, everybody came, and we had a blast. I mean, you know you've had a good trip when you go on a roller coaster ride, a gondola ride, a limo ride 4 times, and a helicopter ride to the Grand Canyon. It's a good trip. And we just had the best time, you know, in the high of the highs. And we got home, and the next day we found out that my son is a heroin addict. And he was shooting heroin. And that's life on life's terms, right? The highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. And once again, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that you guys have kept me in this program, and my God, I'm so grateful that I'm in the middle of this thing, because we knew what to do, right? We knew where to go. It's kind of helpful that I married an addict, because he knew some important people in important places. So he got my son into detox, and then my son went to DePaul Treatment Center. My son stayed there 111 days, even when he didn't want to. You know, and what I did is I kept going to my program. You know, I kept doing my program and let him do his program. My son graduated from there and went to a Central City Concern, a really great outpatient, and he lived there for another 6 months. And I once again stand before you with such glee and such love in my heart, because last April, my son celebrated 1 year of sobriety and clean. And you know what it was? He fell in love with you. He fell in love with you just like I did, man. He got on fire. He's like in the Lano Club, and he's like treasurer of one group, opens another group, secretary of another group. He's GSR of another group. You know, he's just on fire. He's like baking cakes for the pie sale. He's just going at it, doing it. Right? That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. And whenever I get into fear, I just go back to my God. Right? I just go back to my God, and I remember that only when we seek out Him can He allow us to match calamity with serenity, that we never apologize for depending on our Creator, that through Him we show what He can do. And I'm so grateful for that, you know, because a lot of times I get into fear, and then I realize I am not His higher power, and I am not His sponsor. I am neither one of those things. I'm just His mom. And I'm so grateful. And last year we went rafting down the Deschutes River, another great trip with AA. If you ever want to go, give me a call. We're heading out there soon in August. And I'm sitting there last year, and we're going along the Native American lands down the river, and my son is in front of me, and he is robust and big and gorgeous and ruddy cheeks, and he's standing up there shooting water at somebody, laughing with the biggest, most pure joy laughter. And that's a moment, right? That's a moment I get because of you guys and my God. And last January, my daughter got married, and my son was the officiator of their wedding. So once again, I'm sitting there in the front row, and I'm watching my son as he's giving this beautiful speech, and he's marrying the officiator, my daughter and her husband. And I just am so grateful. I can never give back to you guys those moments, you know, to be a part of my kid's life in every shape and form. And I'm so grateful for that. And if you're new here, man, jump in, jump in. Don't dip your toe in and test the water. Jump in with us, swim around with us, right? Get involved, get excited.
did. Go to the meeting after the meeting. Go rafting. Go to the barbecues. Go to the campouts. Do all of that. Find a sponsor. Work the steps. Do all of that. And if you're going to meetings and you're not feeling it, go to some different meetings. And better yet, just stick out your hand. Stick out your hand, because I promise you, someone in AA will grab a hold of it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.